Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So here we are. It's the dark of the moon. It's the dark of the moon when allies gather to determine the course of culture. So let's do that. It's before the new moon on August 4th, which is Obama's birthday, he presiding over Chicago, that we have a story rewrite this time. Okay. It is approaching lunasa, midsummer. We say ritual fire or arson, take your pick. And propaganda seeks to discourage participation. And we're going to play some great de-bamboozling clips from Igor Sushko and Representative Ruwa Rahman, Palestinian state representative in Georgia, who may well be our guest on August 15th, but they're really good. So the tonic antidote to propaganda is participatory animism, intimacy. Right, full-on participation. So deftly, once again, to guide us, be longtime ally, treasured colleague, Sean Pedriac O'Donohue, with his latest book, The Silver Branch and the Other World, Forest Magic with Plant and Fungi. His website is otherworldwell.com. And just for the fun of it, we go, hail to the sun god. He is a fun god. Ra, ra, ra. So welcome, Sean.
Thank you. It's always so good to be here with you.
Wonderful. So let's dive in. We have many, many good things to do. Heat. Where do we want to guide the heat? You know, it's the worst start to fire season in California and everywhere. You know, dangerous fall. You know, it was the wet season in the winter, and the plants all went woohoo, and then the drought, and they dried out. And so here we are. You know, everything, all of flora, fauna, fungi, the park fire, the Tahana County watershed, threatening life, including the Chinook salmon. You know, in the East Bay, you know, Booksellers was gutted by fire this morning, and we go, ooh. So where shall we guide the fire, Sean?
We should guide it to the highest hill where the people gather for the bonfire to celebrate the turning of the year and bring in the right harvest.
Yes. And your splendid book, The Silver Branch and the Other World, this is really part one. We will honor it even more fully. But, you know, you mentioned that it's associated with, it's the Assembly of Lug, right? You can guide us all the way here. And that it has much to do with death, rebirth, and grieving as well. So guide us into these deep realms.
Yes, well, Lu is the grandson of a tyrant. The tyrant was Balor of the Baleful Eye, who had one poisonous eye that could wither anything that it looked upon. And the prophecies had said that his grandchild would be the one who would end his rule. And so he first imprisoned his daughter on an island off at sea, but Mananon, the son of the great sea of being, brought a man of the Tuadye, of the fairy people there, to be with Lu's mother, to become her lover. And she gave birth to triplets who were thrown into the sea. And two of them turned into seals and became the first Selkies. And the third washed up on shore. And that child was Lu, mentored by many, by Talitu, the great woman of the Firbolg, the people of the lightning, who died of her efforts to clear pasture land and who was honored by Lu with great feasting and games and music upon the anniversary of her death, which falls now at Lunasa. But also by Mananon himself, and also by a great warrior woman in Scotland. So Lu trained up, became he of many skills, and showed up at the court of his father's people, asking for admission, and was told, no one may join us, but that he has a skill that is unmatched. And so... he said, I'm a poet. And the guardian of the gate said, we have poets aplenty. He said, "I am a harper. We have harpers aplenty. I am an archer. We have archers aplenty. I am a great swordsman. We have swordsmen aplenty. But have you any among you who has all these skills?" And the answer was no. And so he was admitted to the court and became a leader among the people. And finally, when the great confrontation came on the great plains of the West with Balor, and Balor's eye was opened and lifted and turned towards the Tuatha Dé, and all seemed lost, Lu fired a single stone from a slingshot that hit the baleful eye and turned it inward so that it could only wither the one who brought the withering gaze. And so, in honoring Lu, we honor that possibility of the exact right action at the crucial moment, and the possibility of turning the corrupting gaze back upon itself so it can do no more harm to the world without.
So it is like in our magic backpacks, everyone, you can reach into it and pull out everything that Sean is speaking of, but the Baleful Eye and the slingshot. We have the power of boomerang, and I like spelling it MERINGUE, which is anything bad back to its source with a pie in the face. And it's good. We've seen it be effective with the Speaker of the House going, "Oh, and Biden can't speak without a teleprompter," and then he gets on stage and he's like, "Oh, the teleprompter quit," and he ran away. But more of that boomerang, you know, directing the fire. And I like our to and fro from the propaganda realm, which we'll bring in a moment here. But you also speak of, you know, this story gives way to another old name for this time of year. You'll have to pronounce it Bron Trogen. Bron?
Bron Trogen, yeah.
Bron Trogen,
and so,
means sorrow.
Yeah. Yes, well, so many words in Irish have multiple meanings. And so Bron means sorrow. And when we experience sorrow, we don't say, "I am sad." We say, "Ta Bron Orum," we say, "Sadness is upon me." But Bron also refers to the sorrows and the pains of childbirth. And so it's both the mourning of the earth for what's falling away, but also that beginning of the giving life to what comes next, that stirring of the new life that happens when the seed falls to the earth and takes root. And Trogen can mean the land, and it can also mean the raven. So
I love that.
It can be, yes, it can be sorrow of the raven, sorrow of the land, or labor of the land, labor of the raven, and it is both and all.
So, yes, sorrow of the land, why does the land grieve, you write? She grieves for the life forms that must die each season. Fruit and grain must fall to the ground to become the source of new life in spring. And then, you know, you write, "This season," she tells me, "she grieves for the destruction of the forests that came before the fields. She grieves that her children, the plants and the animals, live in bondage under the rule of people who do not respect them or her." Yeah, and then the raven, here we are, riding on the raven, riding on the back of trickiness itself. Is now a good time for us to just put on the table Igor Sushko for fun?
Yes, let's welcome him in.
Let's welcome Igor Sushko, who's just going to lay out propaganda, and we'll take it from him about why participatory animism and the rites and rituals and the power of, you know, mid-season. So we're at Lunasa, exact mid-season will actually be August 7th. We'll talk about that exact mid-season, but it's close enough. These are the four cross-quarter holidays. Halloween, Candlemas, Beltane, and Lunasa, thought to be the four gates of power, where power, the quality of the season, is especially eager to be invited in to illuminate. So here we go with Igor Sushko, laying out propaganda.
I grew up in the USSR, and there the propaganda you got was alternate reality propaganda. My school told me to love Lenin more than my parents. This was falsehood peddled at you, designed to persuade you of a coherent alternate picture of reality. This is very different to Russian propaganda. Russian propaganda is not alternate reality propaganda. Russian propaganda is post-truth propaganda. It's designed to persuade you, not into an opinion, but into inaction, into not doing politics. Russian propaganda asks you to not have political opinions, but it wants you to have two minimal opinions about political opinions. First, participating in politics is a bad idea. Only a fool does that. Private freedom is good, but public freedom is for idiots. This is an extreme project of depoliticization. The second opinion is a back-of-the-napkin theory of truth, which says, who knows what, if anything, is true? Which is, of course, a self-refuting position. To understand this more deeply, let's look at what I take to be the four central pillars of Russian Putinite propaganda. The first pillar of Putin's propaganda is doubt about truth itself. Here we get to the heart of how this propaganda works. It wants to convert the thirst each human has for truth into resistance to accepting that anything is true. It exploits your desire not to get duped by politics, to get you to doubt everything about politics, and eventually doubt the very possibility of acquiring truthful beliefs about politics at all. To apply this pillar to a terrible thing Russia does in Ukraine, their defense won't be, this isn't true, we didn't do it, but nobody can really know what's true. The second pillar of Russian propaganda is foregoing of consistency. About a terrible thing in Ukraine, the Kremlin might peddle two incompatible messages. It didn't happen, and it happened, but somebody else did it. The third pillar of Russian propaganda is saturation, volume, flooding. About a terrible thing done in Ukraine, this might mean not taking two, but eight incompatible positions. It didn't happen, somebody else did it, it was staged, we did it, but we were forced to, Ukraine did it, NATO did it, the planet Saturn did it, the planet Saturn didn't do it, but its rings did. The fourth pillar of Russian propaganda is motivational internality. Think of this as the maxim that a person is only going to be motivated by what already motivates them. Unlike Soviet propaganda, Russian propaganda doesn't want to put into your head something that isn't already there. It wants to start with what already motivates you and then manipulate that. It's not trying to change your ideology. It's helping you spin out of control via your own ideological logic. Interfering in our democracies, the Kremlin's aim is not to take sides in our politics, but to make our political systems ungovernable by exacerbating what already divides us. Ungovernability is the aim. At this point, we need to recognize that Putin's propaganda has changed in a way that affects Russians, but doesn't affect us in the West. Since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Russian propaganda has moved 20 or 30% back to Soviet-style alternate reality propaganda. The content of this propaganda isn't Soviet. After all, the Soviet Union was a distorted hard-left regime, and Putin's regime is a fascist-sized hard-right tyranny. But the form is Soviet. It is alternate reality propaganda. 70% of the time, the Kremlin now tells Russians, believe nothing and nobody, not even us. 30% of the time, it now says, do believe us after all. We have an ideology to sell you. This is happening because Russia is a fascist-sized regime without a fascist-sized population. The regime knows that this disbalance is unsustainable, but it doesn't know how to change it, when to change it, and whether changing it is something that it can control. To sum up, for us, it's post-truth propaganda. For Russians, it's a combination of post-truth propaganda and alternate reality propaganda.
Oh, Igor Sushko is so smart. Thank you, Igor, for laying that out, and we will tease it into the mythological realm with Sean Padraic O'Donohue and his splendid book, The Silver Branch and the Other World. And I just have to put on the table, this that was written more than a decade ago. It's Israel's style of public relations. It's a quick guide. One, we haven't heard reports of deaths. We'll check on it. Two, people were killed, but by a faulty Palestinian rocket bomb. Three, okay, we killed them, but they were terrorists. Four, okay, they were civilians, but they were being used as human shields. Five, okay, there were no fighters in the area, so it was our mistake, but we kill civilians by accident. They do it on purpose. Six, okay, we kill far more civilians than they do, but look at how terrible other countries are. Seven, why are you still talking about Israel? Are you some kind of anti-Semite? Anyway, just, it's there we go. So propaganda. And we might say, you know, together, Sean, you know, what makes us passive is toxic. What makes us active is tonic. And these myths and these rituals live through us, right? I mean, and it is,
yeah.
No matter what, it's like, you know, a bonfire or arson. So then we go, okay, so we choose here to align and participate, you know, and as Igor says, the purpose of propaganda is to discourage participation disguised as savviness or even progressive, we know too much to play. We'll get to that later. And also exaggerate what separates us, you know. And so really your dedication and this book and this time is about what connects us, what runs in our veins, you know, and this opportunity to gather now and to direct the heat, well, to honor the sorrow and to repent, and then maybe bring back what you introduced too, the raven. How is the raven part of our dynamic now?
Well, the raven has always been a messenger. The raven always speaks truth about what will come if the patterns that exist right now continue to prevail. And the raven is also the raven feathered cloak is the cloak that she who is the spirit of the land wears when she needs to defend her sovereignty when it's under threat. And so later in autumn, we come to the time when we meet the one described in the old stories as the Morrigan whose name was Anand. So the great queen, the Morrigan, and that's she who is wearing that raven-feathered cloak. But we're told her name was Anand, which is the Sanskrit word for bliss, and which is also related to Anya, the name of the midsummer sun. And so she can be both that ferocity of defending the land and her children, but also that bliss of welcoming and granting sovereignty to those who come with true hearts. And truth is such an interesting word, because when we trace back etymology of our English word truth, it's related to the English word troth, now archaic, but referring to our bonds and our agreements. And so when truth dissolves, our troths dissolve as well. And when we become betrothed to the land again, then truth can return.
And we plight our troth, right? That wonderful phrase.
Right.
We plight our troth. And I just wanted to put in here and then toss back and to and fro, but, you know, I'm encouraging that we plight our troth and that we more deeply define politics and political engagement as plighting our troth, as dedication to collective well-being. I mean, some people go, I'm spiritual, I don't engage in politics. And it's like, oh, speak to us about 1930s Germany. Again, it is dedication to collective well-being, and let's imbue the political process with the mythological as well, right, as we go. Politics as sacred ritual.
Right.
And so here we are at this wild wild time, you know, the full moon just only 10 days behind us, right? And it was on July 21st, 2024, which is when Octavia Butler began, well, when her novel, she wrote Parable of the Sower in 1993, but the book begins on July 21st, 2024, full moon, she must have known it, you know, and it was the sun in Cancer opposite the moon in Capricorn. Come on in, Big Mama. Let's have a huge cultural tidal shift, you know, that the Capricornian forms of governance and how we organize ourselves be informed and inspired by our dedication to protecting life. And it's like, ooh, here we go. So there's many ways we want to play with that. And again, you know, before this hour, you can lay out our Lunasa ritual and many things. And I'm just skipping about. And you can, of course, as we know, you can go anywhere you want. But I loved, you know, your opening to the chapter on Lunasa. The sun blazed brightly at noon, but as the day progresses, the tansy and the yarrow dance in the cold wind that blows from the west. In the field, St. John's wort is fading, giving way to goldenrod in the morning. Bears gorge on blueberries. In the fields up the road, while in the forest, the blueberry's strange, otherworldly cousin, ghost pipe, blooms. And across the ocean in both of our ancestral homeland, the hillsides are purple with heather. The rowan is laden with berries. Just, if you feel like it, speak to us of ghost pipe. What is the quality of ghost pipe, and how might we honor that and put it in our magic backpack? What is the quality?
Ooh, ghost pipe is a wonderful walker between worlds. It's a plant that has no chlorophyll, that draws its nourishment from tapping into the mycorrhizal network. But because it's tapped into that vast network where it's weaving together the minds of these old ancient trees that have stood in the same place for centuries, and the mycelial mind that holds everything that's happening across the vast space in a single moment, it needs to know how to keep itself from being overwhelmed by all of the sensation and all of the information. And so very much a teacher for us in these times. And when things become overwhelming to us, it helps us to stand beside them and look on them in a way that allows us to be engaged without being completely under their influence. And I learned this first from Tommy Priester in Massachusetts, who learned it from David Winston, great Cherokee herbalist, who's speaking of this in regard to physical pain, but it's true with regard to emotional pain as well. However, this is a plant that can't be cultivated. It's a plant that's presence is part of the emergence of the mind of a forest. And so one, it's best for people to come to know in essence form or by going to the forest and being present with it, because there simply isn't enough ghost pipe in the world for us to harvest in order to, in every moment, ask it to put us beside our pain. But if instead we can learn from ghost pipe how to be present in those dark places, how to be present in those difficult places without being overwhelmed, then the teaching becomes profound. I think of it so much like Obatala as the one who cools the head. And that white color makes me think of Obatala as well, because it is a ghostly white plant, akin to blueberries and heather, that grows in forests as the forests begin to mature.
So just weaving to and fro, I'm going to bring in, it will be 6 minutes, we'll be a little late for our mid-break, but we don't care, we're on mythic time. Just to and fro, because, you know, Obatala, power of positive Saturn, power of positive leadership. And this is a clip from Representative Rua Roman. She is the first Islamic and Muslim and Palestinian state representative in Georgia. And she starts off angry, and it's, I think, a good use of anger, and she's speaking to us, and we want to just fold this in, and we will integrate it into our mythic thing. So here's Rua Raman starting off angry, good use of anger. Here we go.
Y'all, I've been just so angry, and I've literally tried to make this video so many times because I just like keep getting angry and angrier, so like let's hope I get it through this time. So I'm just gonna focus this on like a from a mis and disinformation perspective, and like hope that at least focusing on process will make me feel a little bit better. But I came across multiple videos, multiple at this point, where people were talking about how voting doesn't matter, and that when you vote, you're actually upholding a system, and that we should just like let the system crumble. And to me, this like comes across as very like rapture type thinking, where you're just like hoping for a day in the future where this like mass event is going to happen and then everything is going to work out. And the thing is that that is not how the world works, even with revolutions, even with mass instability, even with all of that. The people who end up in power are the ones who are most prepared, most organized, and who continue to be most disciplined and strategic. We have none of those things. Our coalition has none of those things, because it seems to me like every 4 years we all develop amnesia about like what voting is, and we end up having the same conversation over and over again. And then next thing I know, I'm like having to spend a ton of money, energy, and time just to convince people to show up to the voting polls where the wait times are like 3 minutes and nobody wants to vote. And I'm like so sorry for sounding so angry, because I'm just like so angry, but like the thing that really, really got to me, and the reason I kind of ended up in this headspace, is that I looked up some of these, you know, content creators who have like tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of views, who are telling you and me that our vote doesn't matter. I looked up where a lot of them lived. A lot of them live in safe blue states. Safe blue states. So that if the federal government decides to be awful, they at least have a layer of protection that the rest of us don't have. And I want to caveat this, because I'm Palestinian, this does not apply to Palestinians. I'm talking about the rest of y'all. I'm talking about those of you who have platforms and who have an audience and who are, who have the audacity to spread misinformation that led us to 2016. And for those who don't remember, in 2016, the Trump campaign actually spent a ton of money on digital ads, and they specifically focused on voters in swing states, where they just like pummeled them with content over and over and over again about how their vote doesn't matter, the system is rigged, nothing will ever change, it is the way that it is, that we have like no influence, blah 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 blah. And do you know why that makes me so angry? Because I have watched us make incredible progress here in Georgia with such a small, scrappy coalition compared to the other guys. And it makes me angry because we are choosing to surrender before we've even fought. And, you know, for those of you who are going to like bring up like money and politics and whatever, I actually just did some math. I did some research on Jamal Bowman's district, and there are about 246,849 registered voters. I pulled this from the New York like Secretary of State's website. A total of 47,489 people voted in that election. That's less than 20% of voters that bothered to show up. And you know who showed up? The pro-genocide squad. I feel like I'm going insane. Because even in a safe blue state, we still need to vote. Whether we like it or not, we still need to vote. And if you're mad about the choices that you have this year, you should have been voting in the primaries. You should have been helping recruit candidates the year before. You should have been organizing in off-cycle years. You should have been applying pressure in off-cycle years. Because here's the thing. Protesting means nothing if you don't have sympathetic people on the inside to do what you're demanding them to do. A million of us can take the streets tomorrow, as we saw post-Trump, by the way, with the Million Woman March. And what did that give us? That gave us the end of Roe. So, honest to God, I'm at a point now where I think that if you are a content creator and you tell people their vote doesn't matter and they shouldn't vote, and you live in a safe blue state, I need to just start putting a disclaimer. Because you are spreading misinformation. And when you say things like Democrats are the same, when over 136 of them skipped Netanyahu's speech and only one Republican skipped, that is not the same. When you tell me, for example, that both candidates are the same, when one of them uses Palestinian as a slur, is the architect of the Abraham Accords, is the reason that we are here where we are. Granted, Biden didn't do anything to reverse the policies. I'm not even going to argue that. You don't need to argue with me. Trust me, I'm not defending anything right here. But then on the flip side, you have somebody like Kamala, who has a mixed record and seems to indicate she's open to being pushed right now. Instead of bothering and focusing on telling people not to vote and how they're upholding a system, which, by the way, when you don't vote, the system just ignores you. on my list, when I go to knock people's doors, the people that show up on my list are the people who vote. I don't see you when you don't vote. It's not on purpose. It's not because I want to. I'm just telling you that is the way that lists and data works in this space. So from now on, I am imploring you, for those of y'all who are making, like, voting doesn't matter, blah, 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 I need you to start putting a disclaimer that you live in a safe state. Because it does matter. And we won and flipped the state by an average of 100 votes per county. And there are people who disagree with us that exist with us in this community and in this country who are not even questioning whether they vote. They show up in primaries where they keep pushing their candidates further right. And then during the general election, they're like, you know what? I'm going to tactically vote and I'm going to at least stay where we are instead of pushing us, you know, to the left and have more progress. Why can't we do that? Why can't we think of voting instead of this, like, moral statement that is permanent? Why don't we just think of it as a tactic, as one of the tools in our tool belts? Why have we decided to entrench ourselves in this, like, mindset that if you vote, that you are somehow committed to a specific morality? You're not. You voted once, and you can go back and keep pressuring the person literally the next day. It's really that simple. And for most of you, it'll take you 5 minutes to vote. It's just, like, so shocking to me that this is still a conversation in, like, 2024.
I love her anger, and Sean, I mean, you and I share our anarcho-animism, right? You have a long history of dedication to myth and revolutionary political action, right? So we love the interweaving of these, right? And a day, a time such as now, really, and the myths are really dedicate, you know, community gathering for dedication to collective well-being. Is that fair enough to say in your dedicated mythic life?
It is, absolutely. And, you know, the election is not the end of the journey. It's a
right.
point in the journey where we have the conditions that exist, and we have to meet the conditions that exist. And I think about coming up as an anarchist, one of the things that influenced me most deeply was Noam Chomsky saying, this vision is like a North Star. It's not a place we necessarily expect to get to. It's a direction we move in. So we move in the direction of liberation. We move in the direction of compassion. And as we do, we move across the territory that we are in.
Right. And magic is a willingness to cooperate with everything. Not condone, but it's true that where Representative Ruel Roman is addressing so much of, you know, that's right. We have crow feather or raven feather cloak, right? I also like, for myself and anybody who wants to, you can imagine the cloak of living ducks. The ducks volunteered so that anything that might get our goat, right, or anything irritating just flows right off us like water on a duck's back, you know. But I'd been noticing people, mostly white people, saying, you know, I'm not going to vote for Kamala because I didn't drink the Kool-Aid. Jonestown survivors hate that metaphor. It wasn't Kool-Aid, you know, and of the issue on Gaza. And you'd said, you know, much word on the streets, in which Representative Ruel Roman is saying, going, we don't know, but here's somebody we can work with, right?
Right. Well, and it's also, there's a degree to which we get the Kamala we summon. And so there are two possibilities. The possibility that I tend to believe is that she's someone who wants to do the compassionate and liberatory thing, given the right circumstances and given the opportunity. And if so, then by amplifying our voices and engaging with her, we increase that possibility. The more cynical theory that I've heard from some people who I really respect is, well, maybe she doesn't have an ideological ground. Maybe she doesn't have a particular set of beliefs. And if that's true, then it's all the truer that it matters how we engage and how we show up. And I think that one thing that's being missed in this conversation is there is so much possibility opened up right now by the fact that there are so many small donors giving record amounts of money. At the very same time, the crypto bros and others are showing up at her door trying to offer very large sums of money.
if the money that is available from small donors is larger than that that's available from billionaires and financiers, then she's more likely to be influenced by collective voices. And we do know that the informed understanding is that she plans to completely clean house at the State Department and the Pentagon and the National Security Council in the upper ranks, because she's not happy with how things are going, which doesn't mean that she's going to be have the foreign policy that I want, but it means it will likely be closer. And it also means there is more room to move her. The only thing that I just disagreed with in what we just heard was that protesting doesn't matter if we don't have the right people in place. It absolutely can. We know that there's a strong likelihood that Richard Nixon didn't drop nuclear weapons on Vietnam because there were too many people in the streets of Washington, and J. Edgar Hoover told him the domestic security of the United States couldn't be guaranteed if he went ahead and did that. So I think that all our tactics matter. Go ahead.
Yep. Sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. Right, and I just wanted to insert that, you know, quirky things all over. When there was a huge protest outside the White House, somebody I know was in a tent smoking weed, you know, and Richard Nixon popped in to their tent. And they said it was really awkward. He wanted to talk about football and everything. But they passed him the joint. And he took it. And he hung out for a while. And it's like, we don't know. Interacting. And yes, we're going to dive, you know, on the other side of our break music here. We're going to dive more deeply into the realm that you bring to us, Sean Patrick O'Donohue, and wonderful book, Silver Branch in the Other World. But I liked what she was saying we want these conversations. We want these conversations. You know, when she said it doesn't matter protesting if you don't have people on the inside. Yes, maybe not. Interesting to put it on the table. The fantastic Jamaican novel Power Game by Perry Henzel, you know, is about how you bring off the Rasta Revolution. And it's like, well, you need some good-hearted person who's actually in the Pentagon to call off the invasion, just a secret person there, and then you need these people, and you need the Rasta people. And anyway, so this divergent thing. But here's our break music, late, but here we go, perfect. You know, and forget who you like or don't like. This is the moon coming in. This is rousing. This is everybody woof, you know, change of climate. And our task is to create the atmosphere conducive to the desirable, that the atmosphere be even stronger than the players in all of their befoibledness. So here's Keb Mo. Here we go.
Put a woman in charge. and she understands. So let the ladies do what they were born to do. Raise the vibration and make a better place for me and you. So put a woman in charge.
Okay, we're fading out on that because it's not one woman, it's not one person, it's an atmosphere. That's what we're shifting. We're part of that rousingness. And then, you know, back to you, Sean, because this is a time where we can invite in, right, the positive well, how do we revere heat and fire and invite that in, you know, so we're how do you like to play with that? What shall we invite in now? The sun is quintile Uranus and Taurus. All of nature is eager to participate with us, right?
Yes. Well, the sun loves to have the green world to dance with. The sun loves to have the plants drinking in that light and loves to feel the plants nourished by it. The sun is that infinite generosity. And that generosity wants to be received. So by making the forests grow again, by making the world bloom again, we please the sun. And in pleasing the sun, we bring fire into its rightful place, so bringing nourishment and vitality.
Wonderful. Right, and your book, your life is full of, you know, again, micro practices of intimacy, participating in everything, you know, the spiritual, the natural, the political, may it all be one thing. But, and it turns out, you know, I opened your book and I was reading, of course, Lunasa, and then it turned out I'd read a lot more of your book than I thought I had, because there are all these places underlined going, it's a magic book. It's a magic book. It was self-reading, but I have things underlined everywhere. But I love also just something we can do. You say, honor the trees. You know, find the oldest trees that share the land with you, and once a week bring offerings to each and sit and listen to them, and find the youngest trees that share the land with you, and once a week bring them water and tell them things you want future generations, human and wild, to remember of the times we're living in. Right? These are beautiful dedication, ritual, strong practices to weave throughout our life, right?
They are. And it's also, we are going to miss them sometimes. And part of the reason why I write these things, we are going to forget them sometimes.
Yes,
and part of the reason why I write these things is to remember. Like hearing this right now, I'm thinking, oh yes, it's been significantly more than a week since I've spoken with the oldest tree on this land, right, since I've spoken with the youngest trees. But I can simply go back and do that now.
Right.
But
But
it's the relationship that matters. And it's also, it's not that it doesn't matter that I forgot. It's that I can come back and say, I'm sorry I forgot. And I'm offering my apology as well, and offering this gift and bringing my presence now. And now I can enter back into being with you more fully.
Yes. Forgetting, you know, as the Sufis say, as is the way of man, we forget, you know, and that's the Piscean quality. What have we forgotten that we must remember, you know, and bring alive, you know, and these powerful times are like, let's bring this alive again, just what you said. So yeah, in the myths, everybody blows it. We all blow it. We forget to, You know, but right now I am putting water out and peanuts in shells for the squirrels, and it's tough for everybody, right? It's 98 degrees here, you know, but we're in DC, you know, we're in this everywhere. It's like put water out, you know, these reweave the fabric of community and kinship, you know, and it's why, you know, you know, vote in any way, you know, vote in all worlds. You vote in all worlds. You know, the election magic councils that Pat Ewing and I have held and will revitalize soon. You know, it's like, because people were like, I don't know, all the things that Representative Rua kind of addresses. But it's like, make your own ballot. Make your own ballot. Draw it. Make it, you know, festooned with trees and things and the thing, and go plant it in nature. And then go vote. Vote in two worlds, right? So, yeah. So what have we forgotten that we must remember? And that's a great deal of your dedication, right? Here's to remember the...
Yeah,
the honoring of the trees, the weaving of kinship.
Yes. Well, thinking about voting in all worlds, in the ancient Irish way, both in the myths and in the old laws, it was the land who cast the vote. She who was the life of the land chose who would be sovereign. Sovereignty was a gift that she bestowed, and she bestowed it on who honored her and honored her own sovereignty. And her own beauty and her own truth, and revoked it when those were no longer honored. And so not only do we need to vote in all worlds, but we need to allow all worlds to vote.
That's great. And hence our word inaugurate, right? Inaugurate, everything is magic. If we go for etymology, comes from the augur, the diviner within all of us, walks out into nature, whereby nature reveals, right? Who would be good enough human would be, or the preferable human, and then they are inaugurated. But say again what you just said before I went into that thing, too. We want to vote in all worlds and allow all worlds to vote as well. Is that what you said, yeah?
Yes, it is.
That's great.
Yes, we need to invite all those voices into the council. It's like our democracy was an attempt to imitate indigenous governance structures that colonizers were beginning to learn from. But there were two things that were hugely forgotten.
Yeah.
And the first was the one that Kepmo was singing about, that was the women who were in charge of decisions about war and peace, because they were the ones who gave life. And the second was that all the beings, all the relations had a part in every decision. The beings of this time, the beings of the past, the beings of the future, as well as the plants and the animals and the fungi and the land and the rivers and the stars and the mountains. And that was true for all people at some point in our history. And just because we didn't get it right the first time around doesn't mean we can't go back and amend things and say, oh, we're so sorry we misunderstood. Now we understand, and let's enter into this new trough.
Trough. I love that. Yeah, and as you say, yeah, the what was excluded from, you know, the indigenous and Iroquois sense of democracy, and they said, where are your women? And this slavery issue, it's not going to work with that either. And, you know, so when we listen to Keb Mo, in case one is grumpy about, I don't know, particular candidates, like, never mind that, there's larger forces, right? You know, let the Council of Grandmothers be in charge, right? It's that's the shift. And I do think it's gender and race heartening. You know, I've been on so many calls, right? So there was the Heather Cox Richardson call with 70,000 people educating what is it to be a good citizen. That was impressive. Then there was the Black women's call. And then I was on the White women's call, which was, you know, 130,000 people raising money. This is all really competent. Then there was the, Win with Black Men call, again, rousing. Then there was the White Dudes call, right? And redefining gender, you know, men protect, right? And it's like, this is an atmosphere, This is a rousing thing. No sense being churlish and not participating. Participate, you know. And you'd said the mayor of Dearborn, right? You brought him up in our backstage conversing. The mayor of Dearborn, who was, you know, adamant for understandable reasons, like we can't vote for Biden because of the Gaza horror. And what has he been saying lately? Just a little more like...
He's been withholding judgment, but he's been saying that here is someone who seems like she may be more open to a different path, and let's try to engage and see if that's true.
Right, exactly. Kamala did put out, you know, after her talk with Bibi, laid out the peace deal, right? And then people were like, we've heard that before and we don't trust her and what you'd have to show me. The phrase, what you'd have to show me, it's like, oh, that is so Harvard Yahweh. What you'd have to show me if you want me to do that. It's like, no, you know, let's show others. Let's, you know, the thing. And yes, you know, the clip that we'll probably pay next week from Representative Roman, but she addresses that too. And she, you know, she's got credibility. But so there was a peace deal laid out by Kamala, which is, you know, withdrawal of troops and the thing and a two-state solution and, you know, autonomy and... pretty good, you know. And again, people go, I've heard that before. And we go, yeah, okay. But of course, Bibi just disrupted that, right? The sketchy right. killing in the Golan Heights, you know, we go, oh. And then the two assassinations bombing Iran and Lebanon. And so we've outsourced Saturn to two men, Bibi and, you know, whoever they are, to Bibi and Tiny Tyro Trump, two men destroying the world in order to stay out of prison.
Right.
So this Lunasa, you know, it's like, well, where do we want to guide the fire, and what shall we transform in the fire? You know, and I loved our ally Evangeline from Minnesota on our Monday trickster thing said, let's have the fire burn up the Electoral College. I'm like, well, that's good. You know, and so since you are however you refer to yourself, but however the presider over the Lunasa bonfire and guiding us in that way, you know, what would you invite us to have burned up and transformed in this fiery time now through August 7th?
That's a wonderful question.
For everybody.
Yeah. So let's burn up all of our ideas of supremacy and superiority and separation. And let them burn into the ash that will be the fertilizer for the seeds that fall to the ground for the world that wants to emerge. And in burning up all those ideas of supremacy and superiority and separation, we're also burning up the idea that we humans alone get to choose. And so
yes.
Feeding that ash, feeding that nourishment, feeding that downward into the earth, feeding it down to she who is the life of the land. We also say, we put this in your hands. Call to us, help us know how to answer your call, how to meet you at your altar and enter that new betrothal.
And the very last thing you said is what? Just repeat that last line.
How to meet you, you who are the life of the land, how to meet you at your altar and become newly betrothed to you.
Oh, beautiful. And my friend, Dr. John Carlson, who used to be head of the Center for Archaeoastronomy, he said, we dig stars. But he said the cross-quarter holidays, here's this one, have been celebrated almost as long as the equinoxes and solstices, 25,000 years, as potent times. And so there's the repetitive rhythmic pattern, and then there's the unique historic now. And I love, as we're convening now, right now, this day, this hour, the sun is at 10 plus Leo, whose image for that degree is children swinging beneath the shade of a huge oak tree, the borrowed strengths of ancient traditions. Yeah, there you go, you're carrying those. Roots, let's come back on roots. The roots of all spiritual traditions in nature mysticism, the door of memory spiraling back through time, the embodiment of the divine in nature, positive spiritual fatherhood. And we go, oh, that's great. So it's rooting for us, right? And the sun quintiles Uranus and Taurus going, okay, the portals are open, you know, let us be irresistibly eloquent in our conversation to and fro with the trees and everybody around. And then roots, you wrote a great thing, a passing reference, and as there's so much nutrient in your dedication, so we'll bring it up now and then dive more deeply in perpetuity. But you brought up the phrase, you know, the root of the problem, and then you said, actually, yeah, can you take it from there, the mitochondria and all, yeah, many roots?
Yes, well when we look at actual living plants, and especially at actual living trees, they don't have a single root. Their roots are many, and their roots are fractal. And so too is the truth of everything that's feeding the situation we're in right now. So we need to follow all of those roots. And of course, in a wonderful response to that, somebody very dear to me spoke of the fact that not only are roots multiple, but there are so many different kinds of roots. Yes. And the qualities of each of those different kinds of roots becomes important. And so, yes, Lunasa, we are the energy is beginning to descend into the earth. We're moving towards the dark of the year. The seeds are falling. The fruits are fermenting. The life will soon be going back down into the roots. And so instead of looking for one root, one solution, let's go into that place of the dreaming of the earth that the many roots carry us into, so that we Beautiful. Can emerge and spring into something new.
So here we go to plight our troth, and thank you always, and we will do many more conversations about your splendid work and weaving it into everything pertinent now. So our guest has been Sean Patrick O'Donohue, his book The Silver Branch in the Other World, and thanks always to Board Up Radha Keel. I'm Caroline Casey. We will reconvene next week. Thank you very much, team. Remember to plight your troth and nurture the trees around you. Woof.